All right, everyone, get ready for another deep dive. Today, we're going to be heading back in time to 1930s Ireland.
1930s Ireland.
1930s Ireland, yeah. Specifically, we're going to be using this chapter from a history textbook, and it covers Fianna Fáil's time in government.
Okay.
So 1932 to 1939. Now, I know when you hear textbook chapter, it doesn't exactly sound like the most thrilling thing in the world, right?
Right.
But trust me on this, okay? This period is absolutely packed with drama.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking political drama, economic turmoil, and and get the IRA is still a force to be reckoned with.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a wild ride. And we're going to try to uncover what made this era so pivotal for Ireland.
Right? Sounds fascinating. I mean, this period really lays the groundwork for modern Ireland, right?
Yeah.
So many decisions, battles, political and economic.
Exactly.
I mean, the effects are still felt today.
Yeah, for sure. And the chapter jumps right into it, starting with Fianna Fáil's win in the 1932 election.
Big moment.
Yeah, and remember, this was the party that opposed the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
Right, right.
So you can imagine the anxiety at the time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The textbook even mentions Eoin O'Duffy.
O'Duffy, yeah.
Who was the Garda Commissioner at the time. He actually suggested that the army should intervene to prevent Fianna Fáil from taking power.
Wow. That's a pretty extreme reaction.
Right.
I mean, considering the outgoing government, Cumann an Gadhiel, led by W.T. Cosgrave. They could have dug in their heels, right?
Right.
Refused to hand over power, but they didn't. They chose to uphold, you know, democratic principles.
Yeah.
Even when faced with a party that essentially wanted to undo their entire legacy. I mean, Cosgrave's commitment to a peaceful handover of power, it really speaks volumes about his character.
It really does. And it's easy to forget in the heat of all these political battles that choosing democracy is a choice. It's an active decision.
It is, yeah.
But, you know, even with a peaceful transition, things were far from calm, right? I mean, the textbook describes TDs carrying guns into parliament. Can you imagine that?
Wow. That must have been a tense atmosphere. Still raw from the Civil War.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, many of these individuals had fought on opposing sides just a few years earlier. So, yeah, while there wasn't outright violence.
Right.
You can bet there was a deep-seated distrust, a sense that anything could happen.
Absolutely. And Fianna Fáil, with De Valera at the helm, made it very clear.
Uh-huh.
Their goal, dismantle the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
Ambitious.
Yeah. And they went about it in a very calculated way.
De Valera, he was a master strategist, wasn't he? He knew that going directly at the treaty,
yeah,
head-on, full force,
right,
you know, it'll provoke a strong reaction from Britain.
Yeah.
So he chose, instead of that, to kind of gradually erode the treaty's provisions.
Right, like picking it apart piece by piece.
Exactly.
And the textbook, it details some of these moves. Well, for instance, abolishing the Oath of Allegiance to the British Crown. Big symbolic move.
Yeah.
And then there was getting rid of the right of appeal to the Privy Council in London.
Right.
So it's like they were systematically pulling these levers of power back to Ireland.
Yeah, and it wasn't just about, you know, these legal technicalities. I mean, these actions were really deeply tied to Irish identity.
Right.
By asserting, you know, their own legal and political sovereignty, they were reclaiming a sense of national pride, the kind that had been, I guess you could say, damaged by the treaty.
Yeah, absolutely. Though it wasn't all smooth sailing, was it? I mean, they ran into some resistance, particularly from the Senate. The textbook mentions some pretty heated exchanges with the Senate.
Oh, right, right. Because the Senate was still largely dominated by Cumann an Gadhiel at that point.
Exactly.
So, yeah, they tried to use their power, you know, to delay, maybe even block,
yeah,
some of Fianna Fáil's initiatives.
Yeah.
It became a real point of contention, especially when it came to, you know, like abolishing the oath. And in the end, this actually led to De Valera abolishing the Senate altogether in 1934.
Wow.
So it just goes to show how determined he was to push his agenda forward.
Yeah. Speaking of power shifts, the whole saga with the Governor General, it's almost comical.
What happened there?
It's like they deliberately tried to make the guy's life as uncomfortable as possible.
Well, I mean, the Governor General, you know, representing the British monarch, he became this symbol of the old order.
Right.
You know, the one that Fianna Fáil was trying to dismantle. So they refused to engage with him socially.
Yeah.
Boycotted events he attended. Even went as far as withdrawing the army band from ceremonies.
Oh, wow.
It was a very public way of demonstrating their rejection of British authority.
It sounds like a very calculated snub. Oh, like, yeah, a way of signaling to both Ireland and Britain.
Right.
that things were changing.
Exactly.
And, of course, they eventually abolished the position completely.
Yep, in the 1937 Constitution.
Right.
De Valera replaced the Governor General with the President of Ireland.
Right.
Largely symbolic, of course.
Right.
But by then, he'd effectively rendered the Anglo-Irish Treaty practically irrelevant, achieved his longstanding goal.
Yeah. So while all this is going on, the world is also in the grip of the Great Depression.
A tough time.
Yeah. And De Valera, never one to shy away from a challenge, decides to double down on protectionism. And he even refuses to pay land annuities to Britain.
Bold move. To fully understand just how audacious that was, we need to remember what those land annuities were. Essentially, you see, they were repayments for loans that had been given to Irish tenant farmers decades earlier to buy out their land from landlords, many of whom were British.
Right.
So, refusing to pay. Direct challenge to British economic interests. A way for De Valera to assert Irish financial independence.
Yeah, a high-stakes gamble for sure. And that's how the economic war kicked off, right? What were the immediate consequences of this economic standoff?
Immediate. Well, the impact was swift and severe. Both sides slapped tariffs on each other's goods, but Britain, they held the stronger hand. They retaliated with this hefty 20% duty on Irish cattle exports.
Ouch.
Which were a cornerstone of the Irish economy. This hit Irish agriculture hard.
Especially the smaller farmers, I imagine.
Especially. They were already struggling.
Yeah. Paints a pretty bleak picture. But the textbook suggests that De Valera was playing the long game here.
Long game. How so?
He believed that this pain, as difficult as it was, would ultimately lead to greater self-sufficiency for Ireland.
That's right. He had this vision of a future.
Yeah.
Where Ireland wasn't so reliant on Britain economically.
Right.
He thought, you know, by fostering Irish industry, reducing that dependence on agricultural exports, that they could build a stronger, more independent nation in the long run.
Right.
I mean, it was a risky bet.
Yeah.
And it did cause a lot of hardship in the short term, but
it was gamble.
It was. Driven by this deep belief in Ireland's potential.
So while this economic battle's raging on, De Valera has his Minister for Industry and Commerce, Sean Lamass.
Lamass, yeah.
Working on making this vision of self-sufficiency a reality. What were some of the key strategies they employed?
Well, Lamass was a dynamic guy. Really embraced this challenge. He set up the Industrial Credit Corporation, or ICC, to provide, you know, much-needed funding for Irish businesses.
Okay.
He also introduced the Control of Manufacturers Acts, aimed at limiting foreign ownership of companies operating in Ireland.
Hold on. How did that Control of Manufacturers Act actually work? That sounds like a pretty bold move to just tell foreign companies, hands off our industries.
It was controversial. The act basically said, for any new manufacturing company setting up in Ireland, a majority of the board of directors and a significant portion of the shares had to be held by Irish citizens. This was designed to encourage, you know, the development of homegrown businesses and prevent foreign companies from dominating key sectors of the economy.
Okay, so they were really trying to nurture this new generation of Irish industries, even in the middle of this economic war with Britain. Did they have any successes? Were there any companies that really took off under these policies?
Oh, there were some notable wins. The sugar industry, for instance, was nationalized.
Okay.
And new factories popped up around the country. Board na Mona, the peat development board, was created.
Right.
To harness Ireland's peat resources for fuel and energy.
Okay.
And then there's Aer Lingus, which went on, as you know, to become Ireland's national airline.
Yeah.
These were all examples of, you know, state-backed initiatives that helped to lay the foundation for a more diversified Irish economy.
It sounds like they were making some genuine headway. But I imagine there were also downsides to this protectionist approach. Was there any pushback?
Oh, absolutely. See, protectionism, while potentially beneficial in the short term, can create inefficiencies and stifle competition.
Right.
And some Irish companies, kind of shielded from those external pressures, struggled to compete internationally and became overly reliant on government support. There were also concerns that the Control of Manufacturers Act might discourage foreign investment and limit Ireland's ability to participate in the global marketplace.
Sure. Makes sense. It's always a tough balancing act, isn't it? Trying to foster growth while avoiding those unintended consequences. And we have to remember that all of this is happening against a backdrop of some pretty heightened political tensions.
Right. The economic war, it was just one piece of the puzzle. The 1930s also saw this surge in political extremism, with both the IRA and this new group called the Blue Shirts adding fuel to the fire. It was a truly volatile period.
Yeah, the Blue Shirts.
The Blue Shirts.
Now, that's a story I want to hear more about. They sound like they brought a whole new level of tension to the mix.
They certainly did. Their rise and De Valera's response to it is a fascinating chapter in the story. It highlights, you know, those complexities of navigating a young democracy, still grappling with its past.
Right.
And facing an uncertain future.
Well, I'm already hooked, but I think we'll save that story for part two of our deep dive. We'll pick up the story with the Blue Shirts, the emergence of Fine Gael, and we'll find out how De Valera navigated this increasingly complex political landscape. See you back here soon for more. Welcome back. Last time we left off with Ireland caught in this this economic war, Fianna Fáil chipping away at the treaty, and the political scene feeling, I don't know, like a powder keg, right? Ready to explode.
And into that powder keg, right? Right. Walks a new player. The Blue Shirts.
Well, yes.
The Blue Shirts, they came out of the Army Comrades Association.
Okay.
Which itself was formed in response to the IRA's, well, the IRA's increasing attacks on Cumann and Guide Heel gatherings. These were ex-soldiers.
Okay.
And they saw themselves as, well, as a bulwark against, you know, what they saw as this a rising tide of Republican extremism.
The textbook doesn't hold back on the imagery here. I mean, blue shirts, Roman salutes. They even had a women's branch called, get this, the Blue Blouses.
Wow.
It feels like, I don't know, like something out of a history book, but it was happening right there in Ireland. What was the public perception of them at the time?
Well, their image, you know, it was striking and deliberately so.
Right.
They drew inspiration from the, you know, the fascist movements gaining traction in Europe at the time. Especially Mussolini's Italy.
Oh, wow.
So this obviously worried the government, as did their growing popularity, particularly among, well, former Free State Army members.
I can imagine.
It raised some serious concerns, I think, about a potential slide toward, you know, authoritarianism.
So how did De Valera respond to this growing blue shirt movement? The textbook mentions that he actually tried to ban them.
He did.
But it seems to have backfired, and pretty spectacularly.
Yeah, banning them was a risky move.
Uh-huh.
And it did backfire. It just served to inflame those existing tensions, right? Make them martyrs in the eyes of their supporters. And as a result, the violence escalated. Clashes between the blue shirts and the IRA became more frequent and a lot more brutal.
And then there's that tragic incident described in the textbook, the IRA bombing that killed a blue shirt member's mother. It's a stark reminder of the human cost of all this political violence.
Absolutely. A terrible tragedy.
It seems this event forced De Valera's hand. He had to act.
That bombing was a turning point.
Yeah.
He had to confront the reality that both of these extremist groups,
right,
they posed a serious threat to the stability of the state. He couldn't afford to be seen, you know,
right,
as siding with one over the other.
He had to be decisive.
Exactly.
So what steps did he take to try to bring the situation under control?
Well, it was a two-pronged approach.
Okay.
First, he banned the wearing of political uniforms, which effectively outlawed the blue shirt's distinctive attire.
Okay.
Symbolic move.
Right.
But it aimed to strip them of that, you know, visual power and also curb their ability to, you know, organize openly.
It makes sense. But what about the IRA? I mean, they were still a major problem.
Well, absolutely. De Valera's initial attempts to kind of appease the IRA with things like pensions and government positions didn't really work, did it? Extremist factions within the organization continued to carry out attacks, including several high-profile murders that shocked the nation.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been such a difficult situation for De Valera, given, you know, his own history with the IRA.
Extremely complex.
Yeah.
But in 1936, after a series of, well, particularly brutal IRA murders, De Valera finally declared the IRA an illegal organization.
It must have been a tough decision for him to finally crack down on, you know, his former comrades.
Tough, but necessary.
Yeah.
Senior IRA members were arrested and imprisoned.
It's a strange twist of fate, isn't it?
How so?
The anti-treaty leader cracking down on the IRA, the organization born out of, you know, that same anti-treaty sentiment, it shows how much the political landscape had shifted.
It does. And, you know, amidst all of this turmoil, we see the birth of a new political party.
Oh, right.
Fine Gael.
Fine Gael.
It came about from a merger of Cumann na Cáil.
Yeah.
The National Center Party.
Okay.
And, surprisingly, the Blue Shirts.
Wow. Talk about strange bedfellows.
An attempt to create, I think, a unified opposition to Fianna Fáil.
The textbook mentions Éowyn O'Duffy, the former Blue Shirt leader. becoming Fine Gael's first leader. How did that work out?
Well, O'Duffy's leadership was, let's just say, colorful.
Okay.
But short-lived. His pronouncements, including, you know, suggesting an invasion of Northern Ireland and partition, proved a bit too extreme for the party.
Right.
So he resigned in 1934.
Okay.
And was replaced by the more moderate W.T. Cosgrave.
So O'Duffy exits the stage, and Cosgrave returns to lead the party he had originally founded. What happened to O'Duffy? Did he just fade into the background?
Not exactly. His final act, you could say, on the Irish political stage.
Yeah.
At least for a while.
Okay.
Was to lead an Irish brigade.
Oh, wow.
To fight in the Spanish Civil War.
Wow.
On the side of General Franco.
A controversial move, to say the least.
It solidified his reputation as a complex.
Right.
And, well, somewhat unpredictable figure.
Yeah, what a wild ride. So we've got this volatile political scene, the economic war with Britain still raging on, mm-hmm. the rise and fall of the Blue Shirts, the emergence of Fine Gael. Mm. Feels like Ireland's, you know, on a knife's edge.
It was a tense time.
So what happens next?
Well, just when things seem, you know, at their most fraught,
mm-hmm.
there's a surprising turn of events.
Okay.
After years of this, you know, bitter economic conflict,
right.
Ireland and Britain, they managed to hammer out an agreement.
Okay.
That brings the economic war to an end. And I think significantly reshapes Anglo-Irish relations.
Ah, yes. The famous Anglo-Irish Trade Agreement of 1938.
That's the one.
It's been called, you know, a major win for De Valera.
Rightly so.
What were the specifics of the agreement?
Well, it was a significant achievement for De Valera.
Yeah.
It addressed several, you know, long-standing issues.
Such as?
Firstly, it settled the question of those land annuities.
Okay.
Britain accepted a one-off payment.
Right.
Of 10 million pounds. A fraction of it was owed.
Okay.
But a symbolic victory for De Valera.
I can imagine that went down well back in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, getting one over on the British, even symbolically.
It was a propaganda coup. The agreement also restored, you know, normal trade relations between the two countries, lifted those tariffs that had been crippling both economies.
Makes sense.
And perhaps most importantly.
Yeah.
It saw the return of the treaty ports to Irish control.
Right, the treaty ports. Remind me again why those were such a big deal.
Well, the treaty ports, they were three strategically located naval bases.
Okay.
On the Irish coast. Bearhaven, Queenstown, and Lough Swilly.
Okay.
They had been retained by Britain, you know, under the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
Right.
Constant source of tension, really.
Yeah.
Symbol of British influence on Irish soil.
So getting those back must have been a huge symbolic victory for De Valera. Like, he finally managed to, I don't know, close the chapter on the treaty, assert Ireland's, you know, full sovereignty.
Exactly. The return of the treaty ports was key, I think, to De Valera's ability to kind of present this agreement as a triumph for Ireland. He could claim, you know, that he had achieved what the pro-treaty side had failed to do,
which was
secure a truly independent Ireland.
But there was one issue that remained unresolved, the elephant in the room, you might say.
Ah, yes. The agreement did not address the partition of Ireland.
Right, of course.
De Valera did raise the issue with Chamberlain,
okay,
the British Prime Minister. But he was told that, you know, no solution was possible without the consent of the majority in Northern Ireland.
It must have been a bittersweet victory for De Valera then, getting, you know, almost everything he wanted.
It was. The issue of partition continued to be, you know, a thorn in the side of Anglo-Irish relations. It would remain a source of tension for decades to come.
Still, the agreement was hailed as this major achievement for De Valera. Strengthened his position domestically, enhanced Ireland's standing internationally. He had managed to navigate this incredibly turbulent period and come out the other side with Ireland, at least in his view, in a stronger position.
It's interesting, though.
Yeah.
Some historians actually see this agreement as a vindication of Michael Collins's original strategy.
Really?
In signing the Anglo-Irish Treaty. They argue that Collins saw the treaty as a stepping stone, you know, toward greater independence, a means to an end, not an end in itself.
That's a really thought-provoking perspective. So even in this apparent triumph for De Valera,
yeah.
the legacy of Michael Collins,
yes.
and the treaty continues to resonate, history is rarely black and white, is it?
It's rarely that simple.
Mm-hmm.
The Anglo-Irish Trade Agreement marked the end, I think, of a tumultuous chapter in Anglo-Irish relations.
Mm.
But it also laid the groundwork for a new, more complex relationship,
yeah.
one that would continue to evolve over the coming decades. It's a legacy that we're still you know, debating and analyzing to this day.
Welcome back to our deep dive into 1930s Ireland. We've been through a lot, haven't we? Political maneuvering, economic battles, the shadow of extremism. But we also touched on the fact that it wasn't all doom and gloom. Fianna Fáil also put in place some pretty significant social policies.
Right. It's easy to get caught up in the, you know, the drama of the economic war, the blue shirts, all that. But Fianna Fáil, they also understood that they needed to address the social challenges facing everyday Irish people.
Right. The stuff that impacts people's daily lives. Poverty, unemployment, bad housing.
Exactly. Especially with the Great Depression, those were huge issues.
The textbook really emphasizes their efforts in tackling substandard housing. They seem to have made some real progress there. What did they actually do?
One of their biggest achievements was a Housing Act of 1932. This act basically mandated government funding for building local authority housing.
So a big shift from the previous government.
Huge. The previous government, Cumann an Gcad Shíol, they'd been much more hesitant to spend money on public housing.
So Fianna Fáil really put their money where their mouth was. What was the impact?
Big impact. Over the next decade, Fianna Fáil oversaw the clearance of slums in Dublin and other cities.
Wow.
They subsidized the construction of, get this, over 120,000 new homes, which is a huge jump from the, well, the measly 2,000 houses per year that Cumann an Gcad Shíol had built during the 1920s.
That's a massive difference.
It was a real tangible improvement for a lot of working class families who had been living in, well, awful conditions.
So it sounds like decent, affordable housing was a priority for them. What about those struggling to, you know, put food on the table? Any progress on social welfare?
Yes, definitely. In 1933, they introduced the Unemployment Assistance Act and the National Health Insurance Act. These provided more benefits for the unemployed, small farmers, and landless laborers.
So kind of creating a safety net for the most vulnerable.
Exactly. It was a significant step in that direction.
It's interesting to see them doing this, you know, tackling these social issues, all while in the middle of that economic war with Britain.
It does show a certain duality to their approach, doesn't it?
Yeah, like they were trying to build a fairer society at home while also fighting for independence on the world stage.
Exactly. They were fierce in their pursuit of, you know, national sovereignty, but they were also really concerned about the well-being of their people.
Although the textbook does mention that they weren't completely successful in reducing unemployment, which I imagine was made worse by the economic war.
True, that's a good point. Despite their best efforts, widespread unemployment, it persisted.
Yeah.
And emigration continued to drain the country of its young people.
People were looking for opportunities elsewhere.
Exactly. It's a reminder, I think, that even with good intentions, governments can't always fix everything, especially when you're up against global economic forces.
And as we talked about earlier, some of their policies, like the protectionism, well, they had some unintended consequences.
Yeah, protectionism, it did help some Irish industries to grow, but it also created this kind of artificial environment that wasn't really sustainable in the long term.
Right.
So some of those industries, they struggled to compete internationally and became too reliant on government support.
It's a mixed bag then, really. Successes and failures, good and bad. But it seems like they genuinely tried to make things better for ordinary Irish people.
I think that's a fair assessment. Right. Their social policies, especially in housing and social welfare, they had a lasting impact. And I think you could say they helped to create the foundations of a more modern and socially aware Irish state.
So looking back at everything we've discussed, what are the main takeaways from our deep dive into 1930s Ireland?
Well, I think we've seen a nation struggling with its identity, trying to figure out its place in the world, caught between its past and its future, navigating this really complex relationship with Britain, its powerful neighbor.
And we've seen how a young democracy can be tested.
By economic hardship and the threat of extremism.
And a government trying to balance.
The need to build a fairer society at home with the fight for its place on the world stage.
It's been a fascinating journey, hasn't it? Through this really pivotal decade in Irish history, the dismantling of the treaty, the economic war, the blue shirts, Fine Gael, we've covered a lot.
We have, and we've seen how all of these decisions, all these battles, political and economic, they've shaped the Ireland we see today. De Valera himself, who's often seen as inflexible, well, he actually comes across as quite a shrewd strategist.
Yeah.
A pragmatist when he needed to be, and a leader who was deeply committed to his vision of an independent and prosperous Ireland.
Absolutely. And this deep dive, well, it's really only scratched the surface. There's so much more to explore, right? And it leaves us with a lot to think about. How did all of this shape modern Ireland? Would things have been different without De Valera? What lessons can we learn from this period about political strategy, economic choices, and the power of national identity?
Those are all great questions, and I would encourage everyone listening to explore further, dive into the source material, read different perspectives, you know, draw your own conclusions. History is not a closed book. It's a conversation. And everyone's voice is a valuable part of that conversation.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into 1930s Ireland. It's been really enlightening. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep the conversation going.